This is John Fisher for the Ultimate Practice Builder for New York Injury Lawyers. Today we have a fantastic guest, which is Sean Doolin. Sean is a partner of the law firm of Doolin and Platt based in Windham, New York, as well as Dobbs Ferry. Sean is the leading attorney in nursing home negligence in the state of New York, and we are very happy to have him on tonight to explain the Assisted Living Reform Act of 2004 applied to assisting living residences. And Sean, first of all, thank you for being on the call. I'd like if you could start out our audience with a description of what an assisted living residence is and how it compares to a nursing home.
Well, John, thank you for having me, and thank you for that introduction. John, there are significant differences between an assisted living residence and a nursing home. And the primary difference is a nursing home provides 24-hour a day nursing care, whereas assisted living residences typically just assist the residents with their activities of daily living, such as dressing, sometimes eating, even assistance in providing medications. But they typically don't provide medical treatments or the level of supervision that is necessary in a nursing home. And historically, they also didn't have dementia units. Now, that has changed as a result of some more recent legislation, which I believe we're here to talk about. And I'll get into that in a moment. But I think the primary difference comes down to the level of nursing care provided, John.
Okay, Sean, can you tell our audience exactly what types of individuals would be eligible for an assisted living facility compared to a nursing home?
Somebody with mild dementia, somewhat forgetful, but can live somewhat independently and can remain in their own apartment, for example, their own room with a closed door safely. Somebody who may need help doing their laundry, may need help eating, may need help getting to a dining room, maybe need some assistance walking, but they're not bed-bound, they're not chair-bound. If you're bed-bound or chair-bound, you should be in a nursing home. And if you are profoundly demented where you don't know who you are, where you are, and you are a threat to yourself or potentially others, you again need a higher level of supervision, and you couldn't be left alone, you know, at night, for example. Now, that we're talking, traditionally speaking, that's been the case. Now, under this recent legislation, that has changed. That dynamic is changing considerably, whereas assisted living residences now are in a position to perform many of the functions of nursing homes.
Okay, let's talk about that. Sean, let's talk about the new statute. You reference it as the Reform Act for Assisted Living Residences of 2004, and that's a New York State statute, correct?
Correct. Yeah, that was signed by Governor Patak.
Now, this law that was enacted in 2004 set up a three-tier system for assisted living residences. Can you explain to our audience what that means?
Yes. It can be a bit confusing, but what New York did was, first in passing the Assisted Living Reform Act, created a licensing scheme where you could be licensed as an assisted living residence. And that would allow you to admit and retain those that are in need of, you know, basic assistance with activities of daily living, some of which we've talked about. But what's really kind of neat about the statute, John, is that now if a facility obtains one of two certificates, either a special needs certificate, which would allow a facility to maintain residents, for example, that have dementia, and where that dementia progresses, when that dementia progresses to the point where they would normally have been transferred from assisted living to a nursing home, now they can age in place and remain in the facility if they have this certificate, which allows them to essentially run a more traditional dementia unit. The other certificate that a facility can apply, that an assisted living residence can apply for under ALRA, is an enhanced assisted living certificate. This will allow a facility, an assisted living residence, to provide essentially 24-hour-a-day nursing care, which was something that was prohibited prior to the passing of ALRA. So now, if a resident is essentially bed-bound or chair-bound and needs nursing, actual nursing care, if certain criteria, and the criteria are very, very involved and very stringent, but if they're met, they can retain that resident in the assisted living residence as their disease progresses to the point where they would normally have been transferred to a nursing home. So they can, the idea behind ALRA was so that residents could age in place, and they wouldn't phase out of an assisted living residence. They could remain there and stay in that facility.
Okay, and the three different tiers that are in the category would be the assisted living residence, the enhanced assisted living residence, and the special needs assisted living residence. Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah, that is correct.
And the facility would require a license and certification for each different type of residence?
They would have to get licensed. This is where it gets complicated. They would have to first get licensed as an assisted living residence. Now, to be licensed as an assisted living residence, you first have to be either licensed as an adult home or enhanced living. Enhanced living was what existed prior to the Assisted Living Reform Act for the elderly, those that are 65 or older. Adult homes were for the younger population. You have to have one of those licenses before you can even apply to be an assisted living resident. So you have to abide by the statutory and regulatory scheme for adult homes or enhanced living. And then once you're licensed as an assisted living resident, you can apply for these certificates that we talked about, the special needs and enhanced assisted living certificates.
Sean, when a facility is certified as either an enhanced assisted living residence or special needs assisted living residence, what type of services are available to the residents there that would be different from those that can be provided in a standard nursing home?
Well, very little, John. Essentially, if a doctor signs off on it and the restrictive requirements are met, which have to do with care planning and bringing in the appropriate nursing staff, et cetera, they can provide essentially all of the services of a nursing home if the right circumstances are met. Now, we're almost a decade into this since the passage of the statute, and I don't know that there are that many facilities that are in a position to do this. But let's say, for example, you have somebody who comes in and they have MS, and over time, when they first come in, they can walk with assistance, but then over time, they become bedbound, chair-bound, they can no longer walk, etc. They can stay there if let's say they bring in a home health care agency to meet all the needs of that resident. A situation where they wouldn't be able to remain is somebody who's dependent on a ventilator would be a good example. They're going to need 24-hour specialized nursing care. You're not going to see them in an enhanced assisted living residence.
What type of services would the residents in the assisted living facility have that are mandatory as compared to those available or required in a nursing home?
You want me to compare and contrast what would be available as far as care?
Sure. For example, with a nursing home, you'd have a medical doctor who's a medical director of the facility. He might not be there at all times, but he's at least available for consultations if necessary. You'd have registered nurses, at least usually one per unit. What about an assisted living residence? Do they have these same requirements, and do they also have different staffing ratios between the residents and the nurses?
Well, they don't have the same staffing requirements, and in fact, there was some recent legislation proposed to require that assisted living residences have at least a registered nurse on staff at all times, or at least during certain shifts, and that was challenged successfully. So that is not a requirement. And one of the points they made is that the industry made the, was that how can we compete with nursing homes if we're essentially going to become nursing homes? And you're going to require us to have a registered nurse on staff. So that's not required. Not required that they have a physician on staff. So those are significant differences if you were to have a loved one in one of these facilities and you wanted that type of level of care, available. There are also differences in how care is delivered in a nursing home versus an assisted living facility. And if you want, we can talk about that.
Well, let's talk about that, Sean. The standard language for a resident of a nursing home would be have an individualized care plan that lays out all their needs and the interventions to address those needs. What is the type of document that's similar to a care plan that would be used in assisted living residence?
It's called an individualized service plan, and it's developed within 30 days of admission. It has to be in place, and it acts as a care plan. It's done. It is interdisciplinary in the sense that you'll have the physician has to be involved. If there's a home health care agency, they have to be involved. The family's involved. And they developed this individualized service plan that has to be updated and revised at a minimum of every 6 months. But this is a very significant point I'm about to make, but also whenever there's a change in the resident's condition. That is new. In the past, I would see that adult homes often would, they were not updating the care plans as the resident's needs changed, and now it's a requirement, and that means they have to in some way be monitoring the resident, and either that's through a home health care agency that's on site, or through nursing care that's being provided because the family's paying for it, through a case manager that the facility provides. But that monitoring is very, very important because as the disease progresses, they need someone there keeping an eye out and updating that individualized service plan.
Now, let's address a situation that you have a fall or perhaps pressure sores or a medication error or something of that nature. What type of documents would the attorney assisting the client in that situation want to look at to determine if there's a case?
Well, I would start with a pre-admission evaluation. That has to be done within 30 days of the actual admission. You need a physician to review that and sign off on it and say that this resident is appropriate for the facility. So if you have somebody, let's say, who's at severely demented, they're at high risk for falls, they need a high level of supervision, then you want to look very carefully to see whether they should have been admitted in the first place. You want to look at that pre-admission evaluation. You want to look at the residency agreement, which specifies the services that are going to be provided. And, of course, you want to look at the individualized service plan that we discussed to see what their plan was in order to prevent falls for that particular resident.
Would you, in the typical assisted living residence, would you expect that there would be written policies and procedures that an attorney can look to for guidance as to whether the facility violated any of its own standards?
That's That's a great question. I am not seeing that they're developing these sort of policies and procedures. What you might see is that the facility has brought in a home health care agency, and the agency has developed policies and procedures. There are some requirements under the statute for the development of policies and procedures, depending on the license that you obtain. But I'm not getting them through discovery in the cases that I've been handling. I'm not seeing anything close to what you would find in a nursing home case, where it's highly regulated federally and on the state level, and they're required, specifically required, to have certain policies and procedures. We're not seeing that level of regulation, and we're not seeing the standard of care is providing for that.
If an assisted living resident outsources the care to one of its residents with a home health care agency, what is the potential liability for the care of a resident between the assisted living residents and the home health care agency?
Well, the home health care agency would contract with the resident or the resident's representative. So there would be privity, and there would be a basis to bring a cause of action in the event that there was a departure from the standard of care by that home health care agency.
Let's talk a little bit about the residents' rights. There is a statutory section of, I believe it's the Public Health Law, Section 4660, that has the residents' rights that apply in assisted living residence. Is that correct, Sean?
Yes, it is.
As an attorney handling cases against assisted living residences, is the Public Health Law section that I just cited of any use in establishing the rights of residents?
Well, John, I think it's a good start, but it's a, you know, in my opinion, very little use, because there's no independent cause of action for a violation of those rights, like you would see under the public health law that applies to nursing homes under Article 28 of the public health law. A nursing home resident whose rights have been violated can bring an independent cause of action with a separate measure of damages per that statute. And the Assisted Living Reform Act they enumerate certain rights, like, for example, the right to receive courteous, fair, and respectful treatment, which is very generic. But they don't have a corresponding cause of action if those rights are breached. Whereas in the state of Washington, they went a step further than New York, and they actually give a cause of action for a breach of those rights. So I think it was a good start. It's a good idea, but you know, I don't find it particularly helpful. Except it does say that that the resident is entitled to their own version of the accident report. So if they give a statement about what happened, they're entitled to a copy of that. That's helpful. But, you know, in a nursing home, the resident has a right to their records. And if they're not provided with those records, that's a violation of their rights. And they can seek damages on that alone. That doesn't exist under ORA. So they enumerate some very generic rights, but you know, to answer your question, I don't find it particularly helpful at this point. I'm hoping they'll go a step further.
Okay, you've talked about the individualized service plan for each resident that addresses the services that will be provided and the staff responsible for providing the services. And you also mentioned that attorneys should look for the pre-admission form. Are there any other records or documents that you'd expect the assisted living residents would keep that would be helpful for an attorney handling his first case?
Well, I think we mentioned the admission agreement. You would want that. Any documentation signed off by the physician, you'd want that. If there is a fall, for example, you talked about falls, there should be an incident report. You would want to request that. There's a case management record that should be maintained. So you'd want to see what records the case manager has maintained. Each resident will have a case manager, and that's also a person you would consider deposing.
What does the case manager do?
Their responsibility would be to monitor that resident, and when there are and make sure the care plan is being followed, and when it's needs to be revised, they would make arrangements for that. They would also make arrangements for any services the resident needed through, say, let's say, a home health care agency. If they had to bring somebody else in, they would arrange for those services to be provided. They would interface with the family. If there's a question or a problem, they would address that. As far as records, that's all I'm thinking of right now.
What other types of individuals would an attorney want to depose from an assisted living residence?
Well, a lot of these facilities have a wellness nurse. And that nurse often acts as a markets for the facility, interfaces with the general public to try to bring in new clients. And then they also will deal with the admission agreements and deal with the initial meeting with the family. And then if problems arise, often the case manager will turn it over to the wellness nurse. So if you have a long admission with issues that are popping up, like a resident who's been trying to get out of the facility or has fallen multiple times, that wellness nurse will be a key person, because they often also interface with corporate. So they'll be involved in some quality assurance and that sort of thing. So I would definitely depose the wellness nurse. I would depose the case manager. We've discussed that. Here's something that's really important. Do not ignore the physician. The physician essentially has to approve of all of the care given in an assisted living residence, especially if these certificates exist, if there's somebody there under one of these certificates. For admission, for retention, revisions to the individualized service plan, they all have to be approved by a physician. So you're going to have a situation where if something happens, the facility is going to, and the care plan, let's say, is not appropriate, the facility is going to point to the physician and say, well, the doctor approved it, so the doctor is the team leader. The doctor approved it, so we just did what the doctor said. And the physician is going to typically point to the facility and say, well, either they didn't keep me informed, they didn't update me of the changes in the resident's condition, et cetera. So while I'm very reluctant to name a physician as a defendant in a case like this, you have to at least neutralize that doctor. And one way of doing that, if you haven't named the doctor, and I have on occasion named the doctor, but if you haven't, then at least depose the doctor, so you know what the doctor's going to say, and you have an understanding of what the doctor's position is going to be.
And Sean, this doctor would be the resident's doctor who basically signed off on his or her admission to the facility, is that right?
Correct. Right. Yeah. To be clear, not a physician that is employed by the facility. Although what I'm seeing more and more today is the doctor is an independent contractor in theory, but actually has an office and a meeting room in the facility, and is much more like staff than not, and some doctors, that's where they get most of their clients from. Most of their patients are right there in the facility, so they're almost like in-house physicians. And so you have to seriously consider naming that doctor.
One of the terms that is very familiar with nursing home negligence cases is the individualized care plan. And family members of nursing home residents are probably familiar with periodic care plan meetings where the needs of the resident are addressed in a nursing home. Is there a similar procedure in assisted living residences?
As far as involving the family in the development of the care plan?
Well, involving the family and periodically addressing the services that are being provided in the individualized service plan.
Well, the regulatory scheme says that they're supposed to involve the family. It doesn't say how, and it doesn't specify what role the family will play. But presumably, they would invite the family to review the individualized service plan or to have input before it's developed. They're going to need the family's approval because it's required that the family be involved. I don't know how it's going to play out. I haven't really seen that, how it's played out. But yeah, you're correct. In a nursing home, the family members are actually invited to these meetings and actually are offered the opportunity to participate. But they're really typically not involved in my experience in the nursing home scenario. Families are actually typically not involved in the development of the care plan. I'm hoping that changes under ORRA, and I'm hoping that with assisted living residences, they do involve the family. And I think you'll probably see that because they'll be going directly from, you know, home to an assisted living residence, and the family will have been providing the care at home. And typically, you don't have a hospitalization in between like you would with a nursing home where you've had a stroke or a fall with a fractured hip and everything's changed. Here, you just may have someone who has mild dementia and the family just determines, well, it's time. We can no longer provide the care. You're going to go from home to an assisted living residence, and I think you're going to see more family involvement in the development of those care plans.
Sean, when a resident goes from an assisted living residence and they want to stay there, but their needs have been dramatically increased, is there anything that's documented in the record that would indicate that they've moved up to the next level, whether that be enhanced assisted living or special needs assisted living?
Absolutely. There are a whole series of requirements. It's a long list. But the predominant requirement is that the physician deems it appropriate. And the physician has to say that nursing home care is not required. So the physician has to do two things, really. They have to say that the needs of the resident can be met in an assisted living residence, and also that they don't need nursing care in a nursing home.
What type of experts do you rely upon in the cases that you have involving assisted living residences?
I've had a very difficult time finding the appropriate experts. I have used former administrators of home health care agencies. I have a few experts that you know run and operate home health care agencies that I've used as experts. I've been fortunate enough, but I've had to go out of state to find a former administrator of an assisted living residence. I have also a nurse who has worked in an assisted living residence, again, out of state. I have had a difficult time finding anyone here in New York, in the New York metropolitan area that is willing to come forward and act as an expert in these cases. It's a growing industry, and we're going to see more and more of these facilities. You know, the goal is to get federal funding to these facilities, and once that happens, you're going to see a real shift from nursing homes to assisted living residences.
Sean, let's address that for a second. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but these facilities are primarily for-profit entities that rely upon payment, not from a government source, but primarily from the residents. Is that correct?
That is correct.
There
are fewer of them than you might think.
And for that reason, is this a growing area where residents are going to assisted living residences as opposed to nursing homes because they can provide? Well, let me ask you, how do you see it in the future that this is a growing area, assisted living residences, or something that's going to be more static?
Well, I think New York was ahead of the curve in passing this legislation. I applaud New York for that. There's no question that there's a movement by certain special interest groups like ARP to get the federal government to fund through the Medicaid program assisted living residences, and they're lobbying for that as we speak. And I think it will ultimately happen as we have an aging and growing population. There's going to be a need to provide care, and there's a significant savings in providing care in an assisted living residence versus a nursing home. And you want to naturally have people in the least restrictive environment anyway. So that's clearly the direction we're headed in. I don't have a crystal ball, but you know, in my opinion, that's where we're going to end up. There's going to be, I think, a boom in this industry, an enormous growth in this industry. It hasn't happened yet, but I don't have any statistics in front of me at the moment, but I do have statistics on this, and it is growing, and I anticipate that once the federal money flows to these facilities, it will grow significantly.
Sean, you've provided our listeners with some great information about assisted living residences. Before I let you go, I have two quick points I want you to address. Are there any specific practice points you can give our audience? And also, is there anything about the Assisted Living Residence Reform Act that you believe needs improvement?
Well, why don't I start with the second question about improvement? As you know, John, I'm very passionate about the subject of long-term care, and you know, unfortunately, New York did not provide an independent cause of action for a violation of assisted living residents' rights. So I would like to see that. I would like to see the rights developed a little bit more. I think that will help. I'd like to see residents have a specific right to obtain their own records. I think that would also be very helpful. As far as practice points are concerned, probably the number one practice point I will give you and any listeners is to call the Department of Health and file a complaint or have family file a complaint with the Department of Health, because the Assisted Living Reform Act allows for that. And would you like me to give you that number?
If you have it, sure.
Yeah, it's 866-893-6772. Now, a lot of my colleagues don't do this, and I have found it to be very fruitful, because the family will file a complaint. The Department of Health will get in there. They will review the records. They will interview witnesses, and as you know, John, they will issue a report. And you can FOIL that report, and you can refoil the investigative file as well. And I often get the incident report through that FOIL request. And you know very early, often very early, whether you have a case, at least from a liability standpoint. And a lot of my colleagues don't do it. They think it takes too long, or they don't like the idea of the Department of Health coming in and not making any findings. That doesn't concern me in the least, because they are not looking for negligence. They are looking for violations of regulation. That is different, as you know. So I'm looking to see what the witnesses have said. I'm looking to see what the investigative notes report. I'm looking at incident reports. And so I highly recommend that. I would also say look very, very carefully at the physician, because the physician can really hurt you or potentially really help you. So you want to look at that liability very carefully, and I would caution anyone that handles these cases to proceed very carefully because they are very complicated, difficult, expensive cases. You're going to be acting sort of as a pioneer in this area if you handle one of these cases. So you want to make sure that it's done right to get the best possible result for your client. The other thing I would do, John, probably the first thing I would do is go to the Department of Health website, go to their licensing section, and see how the facility is licensed. From there you can figure out what statute applies and what regulations apply, so you know what you're dealing with. And that's all, you know, on the website and easily obtainable. I would also FOIL it, because sometimes the website is not up to date. I would FOIL it, and I would also get it through discovery.
Sean, before I let you go, there's one thing I've got to ask you. You said that you'd like to see changes in the law so that the residents have the specific right to obtain their own records. What you're telling me is the residents don't have the right to get a copy of their own record?
Well, it's interesting. I have had situations where they have not been able to get the records, and I have had to go to the Department of Health and call them and get the Department of Health involved and threaten to pull a license for the failure to provide records. You shouldn't have to do that. It's your record. It's a record of what happened while you were there. You should be able to obtain it. We don't have that, you know, that threat that we have under under the public health law for nursing homes, where it's federally regulated and states that you have this right. So I have had situations where my clients have not been able to get the records, and it's taken, ultimately we've gotten them, but sometimes it's taken 6 months, 9 months, a year just to get the records.
When you contacted the Department of Health, did that help you get the records?
Immensely. Yeah, they actually got involved.
Well, hey, Sean, it's a lot of information. And as you pointed out, this is a very complex new area, and it's a great deal of information that is similar but different than nursing home negligence cases. If any of our attorneys listening to this podcast would like to contact you, either about a referral of a new case or just to speak with you and consult with you, how would they go about reaching you?
Well, I'll give you my direct phone number. It's 518-621-4209. Or they can email me at sean@doolinandplatt.com. Sean is spelled S-E-A-N at doolinandplatt.com, doolinandplatt.com.
Well, hey, thank you very much, Sean. I appreciate your time, and I look forward to even learning more from you as time progresses.
Take care. Thank you for having me, John. I hope I've been of some help.
You have been. Take care, Sean.